Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Everyone, it's 4 o'clock in the East. Mark today as the day President Biden turned the page on 4 years of chaos and humiliation for the United States under former President Trump. A high stakes and high profile summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It was the first major foreign policy moment of the new Biden presidency and a brand new chapter in relations with an historic adversary. President Biden making it clear that the U.S. will not tolerate Russian cyber aggression or election interference. Bringing human rights and democratic values back into focus for the U.S., while also rebutting attacks on American democracy by Putin.
I made it clear that we will not tolerate attempts to violate our democratic sovereignty or destabilize our democratic elections, and we would respond. The bottom line is, I told President Putin that we need to have some basic rules of the road that we can all abide by.
Those comments came on the heels of a solo press conference from Vladimir Putin, who himself noted the 180-degree reversal from the former guy and described talks as constructive, but used the moment to needle the U.S. and deflect on a range of issues from cybersecurity to human rights. He compared his repression of dissidents there to the treatment of the insurrectionists, the criminals who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. The summit and the remarks by Biden, a striking contrast to the last time an American leader met with the Russian president, when Donald Trump in Helsinki lavished praise on Putin, choosing to take his word and believe an autocrat who undermined American democracy over the assessments of his own intelligence community. It was a shocking moment here, and one that also had U.S. allies questioning whether America was still capable of leadership.
I also told him that no president of the United States could keep faith with the American people if they did not speak out to defend our democratic values.
I hold both countries responsible. I think that the United States has been foolish.
How would it be if the United States were viewed by the rest of the world as interfering with the elections directly of other countries and everybody knew it? What would it be like if we engaged in activities that he is engaged in? It diminishes the standing of a country that is desperately trying to make sure it maintains its standing.
I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
I also told him that no president of the United States could keep faith with the American people if they did not speak out to defend our democratic values, to stand up for the universal and fundamental freedoms that all men and women have, in our view.
An American president confronting the other guy is where we begin today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, is here. Also joining us, Ben Rhodes, former deputy national security advisor. And Jeremy Bash is here, former chief of staff at the CIA and the Department of Defense. Lucky for us, all three MSNBC contributors. Ambassador McFaul, take me through what you thought first of what happened in the room, and if there's anything you can tell us about what hasn't been made public yet.
Well, first of all, thanks for the compare and contrast between Helsinki 2018 and Geneva 2021. I think it is important for everybody to remember what a disaster Helsinki was and how much of a correction this meeting was. In the meeting itself, we just hear the readouts of the two presidents. President Putin sounded like it was very constructive, workmanlike. He liked the tone. And President Biden did basically as well. There weren't giant achievements here. Let's be clear. When they put out a joint statement that they are going to talk about launching strategic stability talks, that's just a very first tiny step towards doing anything concrete. And they restored ambassadors. So their ambassadors, you know, is going back to Washington, and our ambassador will go back to Moscow. But remember, Putin was the guy that moved out Ambassador Antonov in the first place. So that's not a big achievement. And I think President Biden said it very well in his press conference. He wanted to meet with Putin directly to try to see if they can cooperate on a few other steps. And by the way, Syria, Iran, some other issues, the Arctic came up as well. But the proof is in the pudding moving forward. So far, all they've done is set out aspirations. Now we'll see if we can actually concretely do anything together. And I think the verdict is still out on that.
One thing that is clearly the Russian strategy is to equate advocates for democracy in Putin's autocracy with the criminal insurrectionists in America. Ambassador McFaul, just talk about that. As it, to me, it reeks of desperation. His buddy Donald Trump is gone, so let's side with the insurrectionists. It feels like low-hanging Fox News fruit, but is that what we are to believe of Vladimir Putin?
Well, Nicole, that for me was the most outrageous segment of Vladimir Putin's very lengthy press conference. It was like a greatest hits of his whataboutisms, but that was the worst. Because let's be clear, Alexei Navalny, the person he's calling an extremist, is peacefully exposing corruption in Russia to try to bring about democracy in Russia. And the insurrectionists that stormed the Capitol broke the law in the United States to seek to undermine democracy in the United States. So somehow to equate those things is radically wrong. And I'm glad President Biden called him out on that in his press conference. That was very appropriate in my view.
You know, Ben Rhodes, as a message person, I am struck by the messages coming out from both men. I saw Ann Applebaum, who is you know, I think always looking for sort of these signs of strength in defending the democracy itself, talking about a proportional response to be expected from Putin if there are more cyber aggressions. I wonder if you can sort of speak to what you heard behind some of the messages, which are always careful in these settings. And I think as the ambassador is indicating, sometimes the real outputs and results become known in the coming weeks and months.
Well, I think for Putin, it was quite straightforward. I mean, that was the same litany of whataboutisms and denials that you'd expect here from Vladimir Putin. And he wants to basically pocket, in his view, the win of this summit, show that he's on par with the U.S. president. He's an equal as a superpower with the world's greatest superpower. And that's what he did. I think there was a number of things that I noticed about Joe Biden's messaging that was quite interesting. And first, hugely welcome that he just spoke up for things that Americans and people around the world want to see the American president speaking up for. You know, when Alexei Navalny was poisoned by Vladimir Putin and nearly killed before he was detained, Donald Trump wouldn't even say his name. Quite like, by the way, Vladimir Putin, who won't say Alexei Navalny's name. And now we have an American president who's not just speaking generally about human rights, but very specifically about Alexei Navalny and the Russian opposition that has been so brutally targeted by Vladimir Putin. It was a shift to kind of a candor in the relationship in public that I think probably mirrored the messages that were delivered in private. I also think that Biden did an interesting job, Nicole, and you've been there in the White House, of setting expectations. He did not want to overpromise that this one meeting is going to transform this relationship or somehow change Vladimir Putin. What he did indicate is, look, I laid down some markers. And so, for instance, on this issue of cyber attacks, sure, Vladimir Putin came out and denied he did them and acted like there's no problem. But Biden made clear, look, I told him in private that there's going to be a response if this continues, and kind of laid down that marker and said, look, we're going to see what happens from the Russians over the next 6 months to a year. We're going to evaluate, are they going to continue to be these cyber attacks? Are we going to continue to see the kind of relentless crackdown of the opposition that we've seen there, support for autocrats like we've seen in Belarus? And Biden was kind of setting the table that if the ball is now in Vladimir Putin's court, and if he doesn't reciprocate by essentially curbing some of these excesses in his own behavior, there will be responses from the United States, but I'm not going to detail them precisely for you. So I think Biden was both setting expectations, delivering warnings, and speaking not just to the audience of the American people and the Russian people, but to the world, that the American president is once again going to speak up for basic democratic values and basic international norms and standards.
Jeremy, the fact that that is what is news in and of itself, that we have an American president using his bully pulpit to advocate for human rights. Let's listen to it.
It's not about just going after Russia when they violate human rights. It's about who we are. How could I be the president of the United States of America and not speak out against the violation of human rights? We don't derive our rights from the government.
We possess them because we're born, period. And we yield them to a government. And so the forum, I pointed out to him that that's why we're going to raise our concerns about cases like Alexei Navalny. I made it clear to President Putin that we'll continue to raise issues of fundamental human rights, because that's what we are. That's who we are.
Jeremy Bash, your thoughts on that and everything you saw today?
Well, for six decades, Nicole, we've had a bipartisan consensus going all the way back to John F. Kennedy that the United States was going to confront first the Soviet Union and then the Russian Federation on a range of issues, strategically containing them, but also speaking up for some universal democratic, small d, democratic values. And you saw that in the context of the United States in the 70s standing up for the rights of emigres. You saw that in the context of support for the solidarity movement and the lifting of the Iron Curtain around the time that the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, the crumbling of the Soviet Empire. And you see that now, and you've seen that in the modern era on a bipartisan basis, with one exception, which is the past 4 years. Donald Trump didn't stand up to Putin. On the other hand, on the contrary, he not only gave him a yellow light, in some cases, he gave him a green light. He welcomed the election interference. He welcomed the undermining of democracy. I think so many of the cyber attacks we've experienced are because we didn't establish deterrence. And so in some respects, the Biden administration and the West have been playing catch up. And how relieving it is to see that the West is now unified. It's resolute. There's a strong NATO alliance to stand up to Russian aggression. There's a strong alliance of democracies in the G7. The West is unified. And I think Biden went into this meeting today with Putin with the wind at his back. And I think the Biden administration got done this week what it wanted to do. It had the sharpened contrast between democracy and autocracy. And for the universal values we've been talking about, nothing, Nicole, nothing could be more important.
Let me just press you on that, Jeremy, because you're right. The West is united, if you mean President Biden, a majority of Americans who support him, and the leaders of NATO. But the U.S. is not divided. And I'm certain that someone told Vladimir Putin what Tucker Carlson led with last night, that the insurrectionists were not insurrectionists at all, but FBI plants. I mean, I hear you, but is it too late? I mean, has Putin already succeeded in deputizing people to do the very work he did in 2016 here on the American airwaves for him?
Well, President Biden actually talked about this in Europe this week. I was a little bit surprised he went there, but he was asked a question in his press conference about the political dynamic in the United States. And he said, look, those who are advocating for insurrection, those who are advocating these anti-democratic values, anti-rule of law, anti-truth, you know, they dominate a political party to some extent here in the United States, but they don't represent the American people writ large. And I think he's right about that. And I think he can credibly say in capitals in Europe, and we sit down with Putin, that the United States of America stands squarely in favor of democracy, in favor of human rights, in favor of the rule of law, and that this is something we have to work, obviously, in our country to perfect and to work on, but it's also something we have to export to the world and ensure that we remain united on.
Ben Rose, I want to bring you in on this. This is the topic of a book you've just written. I mean, the specter of an American president, yes, having the majority of Americans, he won by a 7 million vote margin. That is accurate. He has all of the U.S. allies on his side on the question of democracy. But you have an alignment now, more public and more striking than at any other point, between the American right and Vladimir Putin. How do you deal with that?
I think it's the central challenge, Nicole. And look, I think Vladimir Putin represents the darkest place that this strain of nationalism and authoritarianism can go. In that book, you know, I profile Zhanna Nemtsova, a young woman that Mike knows well, whose father was literally assassinated in the shadow of the Kremlin, Boris Nemtsov, a Putin opponent. I talked to Alexei Navalny, who's been poisoned and imprisoned just for exposing corruption. And yet at the same time, faced with that kind of authoritarianism, you have this embrace of the similar type of messaging from the American Republican Party. Essentially, there's a symbiosis here between the brand of politics that Putin practices in a particularly brutal way and the kind of disinformation and misinformation that we see shaping how so many Republican elected officials behave and how their supporters act, in the most extreme case on January 6th, the most important thing Joe Biden needs to do to defend democracy is make sure that democracy survives here in the United States, to make sure that we are guaranteeing basic rights like the right to vote here in the United States, because that's what we have to do to have the standing to talk about that around the world. So it's, I think it's very important that he deliver these messages on the world stage, but the world is watching our democratic example. And at the end of the day, even through that conflict with the Soviet Union, Ronald Reagan himself put it this way, we're a city on the hill. People are looking, people are watching. And I think the most important job that he has to do to I think, deal with Vladimir Putin is actually when the plane gets back to the United States. It's not in that summit meeting. It's making sure American democracy thrives.
Ambassador McFaul, you talked about this being the most outrageous part of what Putin said after the meeting. I just found this. Let me play this. This is Putin on the insurrection. Let's watch.
The list of your political opponents who are dead, prisoned, or jailed is long. Alexei Navalny's organization calls for free and fair elections, an end to corruption. But Russia has outlawed that organization, calling it extremist. And you have now prevented anyone who supports him to run for office. So my question is, Mr. President, what are you so afraid of?
Okay. Once more, let me reiterate what was already said about various so-called foreign agents and about people who are positioning themselves as the non-systemic opposition.
You didn't answer my question, sir. If all of your political opponents are dead, in prison, poisoned, doesn't that send a message that you do not want a fair political fight?
As for who is killing whom or throwing whom in jail, people came to the U.S. Congress with political demands.
So, Ambassador McFaul, it illustrates your point, but I think it can't be conveyed directly enough that he is saying what is being poured into the minds of millions of Americans. There is a complete message alignment, the defense of the insurrectionists, the idea that one, they weren't violent, or two, they weren't really Trump supporters. The first story was they were Antifa. The latest is that they were FBI plants. What do you do on the world stage to sort of quell anxiety about that alignment in message?
Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to the American journalists that were in the press conference with Putin.
Me too.
They had a great set of questions. That was fantastic. That was fantastic. And there were others too. Ann Simmons from the Wall Street Journal asking a really tough question in Russian. That takes some bravery, believe me. And by the way, just on the, I want to get to your really fundamental question in a minute, but the idea that they had these two press conferences and there was all this chatter, oh, they're, you know, Biden's not standing up to Putin. I actually think it played to our advantage in that they got to ask direct questions to Mr. Putin. And if the two of them are standing up there, then they can bat it back and forth. This was a much better format. And I really want to praise the American journalists in the room for what they did today. But on your point, we have talked about this, Nicole. The battle between democracies and autocracies is not just between states. It is within states. It is within Russia, as we are talking about. It is within the United States, as you were just talking to Ben about. But it's also within Italy and France and Hungary. Viktor Orban, is he closer to Putin today or to the democratic values that he's supposed to be a part of in the European Union and NATO? And that is a serious struggle, and it is striking, to your point, that the same talking points that autocratic forces in America use are exactly what Vladimir Putin was discussing today. Even Black Lives Matter, he went after them, saying they're insurrectionists. That is dangerous. And I'm optimistic. I want to be clear. I think, as President Biden said, the majority of the American people support democratic values. And the majority of the people in the world, if you look at Gallup and other Pew opinion polls, support democracy. But remember, in this fight between autocracies and democracies, the autocrats don't need to have a majority to win. They play by a different set of rules.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, Jeremy, just to come back to you, you kicked this off. But I think that's the point of all of this, right? Of course, an American president stood up for America. It's news because the last guy didn't seem to do that ever. But our democracy is weakened by the fact that half our country is echoing the things that the other guy said after that meeting. And I wonder if you share Ambassador McFaul's optimism.
Well, I do. I think we will be united again. I think this spasm of ideology in our country is temporary. But I do think, to your point, Nicole, it is aligned with Putinism. It is aligned with these anti-democratic, anti-truth, anti-rule of law forces. And I would just say that whenever an American president goes overseas to sit down with the Russian president or whomever, you know, I'm rooting for Team USA. And I have to say, it pained me a great deal to see us get sacked for such a loss behind the line of scrimmage in Helsinki in 2018. We took one on the chin. The United States and our values took one on the chin. And today was a refreshing change. We marched down the field in a pretty business-like fashion, kept the team together and put some points on the board for democracy and for our values. And that's what I think it should give comfort to people all around the world watching, and hopefully will continue to unify our country.
Jeremy Bash, Ben Rose, Ambassador Michael McFaul, I have wanted to speak to all three of you all day long. Thank you so much for starting us off today. We're very grateful. When we come back, President Biden's critics actually slamming the summit with Putin before he even touched down in Geneva, how that stacks up to where they were on U.S.-Russian relations over the last 4 years. And turning to other headlines today, nearly two dozen Republicans voted against honoring Capitol police officers because they say January 6th wasn't an insurrection at all. Well, they can tell that to some of the prosecutors on these cases who are saying today the lies that fomented the insurrection are still out there in the minds of these defendants. Plus, the criminal investigation into Trump Organization's CFO appears to be heading into its final act. Will it lead to a sequel starring the former president? All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download. Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
We have some breaking news to tell you about, breaking in the New York Times. We're learning that today the Garland Justice Department has taken one of its most concrete steps yet to erase 4 years of gross politicization of the vast prosecutorial power of the United States Justice Department. The story will sound familiar, even if the actors aren't. Bill Barr, at the urging of Donald Trump, was investigating Donald Trump's ex-national security advisor, John Bolton, for allegedly disclosing classified information. The problem for the Barr DOJ was always this. A career national security official had reviewed Bolton's manuscript and had testified to the opposite, that there was no classified information. She'd cleared it. Her name is Ellen Knight. She's a former senior director at the National Security Council who conducted that pre-publication review of Bolton's book. Here's what her lawyer writes. Quote, upon the first reading, it was apparent to Ms. Knight that the manuscript contained voluminous amounts of classified information. It would take a significant effort to put it into publishable shape. The ensuing review ultimately became the most intensive pre-publication review process in recent memory at the NSC. As a last step in the process, Ms. Knight gave the manuscript to the acting director for access management, a 20-year classified information expert with original classification authority, who to that point had not been involved in the Bolton review. He carefully read the manuscript to confirm, and he did confirm, that it no longer contained any sensitive or classified information. John Bolton had that letter before he published his book. Ken Weinstein was one of the lawyers involved in today's breaking news. And let me read from the New York Times account of this development. Under the headline, let me get it right, Barr rebuke from the Garland Justice Department The Justice Department has closed a criminal investigation into whether a disparaging memoir by President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton illegally disclosed classified information, and it is finalizing a deal to drop its lawsuit aimed at recouping profits from the book, according to two people briefed on the matter. Let me bring into our conversation, as if on cue, Frank Figluzzi, former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence, host of the podcast The Bureau, and Charlie Sykes, Editor-at-Large of The Bulwark, both, lucky for us, MSNBC contributors. I'm sorry to throw breaking news on both of you, but if there's a story that both of you can handle better than anyone, it's this one. So, Frank Figluzzi, explain how this ever got out the gate, when the process of removing any classified information was one that was attested to by career national security officials. The Barr DOJ seemingly proceeded with a criminal investigation anyway.
Well, you've kind of answered your question by the content of the question. By that, I mean this could not have happened if both the White House and the DOJ were in on it, right? So the White House could be upset that someone's publishing a kind of tell-all book about the inner workings of national security discussions during the Trump administration. But in order to go scorched earth and absolutely go after the proceeds of the book, try to block it from being ever published, you got to have your AG in on it, and you got to have some prosecutors in on it. And that's how this was allowed to happen. This was just another case of trying to silence somebody. No matter what you think of John Bolton, this was an effort to silence a man who simply wanted to tell his story. And Trump didn't like the story, and he brought in his DOJ to do his bidding. Today, Merrick Garland's DOJ is saying enough is enough. No criminal case. And by the way, it appears from this reporting, John Bolton can likely get the proceeds from the sales of his book.
You know, this feels like it's about the tip of the iceberg that is showing us that underneath is something so much uglier, Charlie. And by that, you know, John Bolton is no political ally of the Biden administration. But if this case was politicized, if this was about factless, baseless political retribution, what do people think he did to Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell? For you, Charlie.
Charlie,
you're frozen and we can't hear you. Can you hear us?
Oh, I can hear you now. No, if there's a theme to the news today, it is that normality is newsworthy. When you have the president actually behave like the president of the United States at an international summit, and the attorney general basically saying that we're not going to use the power of the federal government to simply ignore all of our laws and suppress speech. Look, this was a rogue administration, and we knew this. What I think is becoming more and more clear is how far the abuses of law enforcement would have gone on this administration if there had not been pushback occasionally. But in this particular case, in a lot of ways, it's not surprising. You know, that Donald Trump is sitting in the Oval Office and he's issuing orders to his Department of Justice to harass and punish his critics. This is exactly the kind of abuse of power that you don't want to see. It's the kind of abuse of power that other attorney generals would have resisted and pushed back against. And so it is refreshing to see that we're kind of reverting to the norm that the president of the United States should not be able to crush his opponents in the way that Donald Trump tried to crush many of his critics, including John Bolton.
I want to bring into our conversation one of the reporters who broke this story at the New York Times, Washington correspondent Mike Schmidt. Mike Schmidt, what do you know about the process, the review process for this Bolton case by the Garland Justice Department?
Well, when the Garland Justice Department came in, they sort of looked at this case as they looked at a range of other matters that the Trump Barr Justice Department had done and sort of evaluated it. You know, it's similar to the E. Jean Carroll lawsuit decision that was made last week. They looked at this decision and they realized that allowing a lawsuit to move forward would, you know, it could potentially expose some wrongdoing on the side of the Trump administration and the Justice Department. But that was no reason for essentially a meritless suit to move forward. And they were willing to put this matter behind them and to reach this deal. And the, you know, the most important, I mean, there's two major aspects here for Bolton. The first is that he gets to keep his money from the book. The government will not try to recoup that money because of how the Bar Justice Department said he didn't follow the pre-publication review process. That's the way that his book was reviewed for classified information. The second thing is that the criminal investigation has been closed. We know as of last fall, the Bar Justice Department was looking at whether Bolton had broken the law by disclosing these classified details, you know, what Trump said was classified details in the in his book. And now Bolton being told by the Justice Department that that has been closed.
What does it say that this Justice Department looked at the facts and didn't think the facts measured up to a standard to criminally prosecute John Bolton? Were facts manufactured by the Bar Justice Department? Were facts politicized? I mean, you know, it feels like a pretty clear rebuke of the most sacred powers of the United States Justice Department, criminal investigations and criminal prosecutions.
Well, it certainly is a significant reversal of the position that the Bar Justice Department took, perhaps one of the biggest ones that we have seen since Garland has come in. There have been a lot of questions about what Garland is going to sort of back up or go along with that had begun under Barr. And this is one of them that they put an end to. And if you think back to it, this was a wide-ranging effort by the Justice Department. It had used both its civil and criminal powers to examine Bolton. Remember, they tried civilly to initially stop the publication of the book by going to court. And it was in the aftermath of that that the criminal investigation was opened.
Mike, stay with us. Frank, let me bring you back in. I think as we seek to understand how the Garland Justice Department is going to, in effect, decontaminate all of the tentacles that the Bar Justice Department inserted into, I believe it was the sentencing phase where he got involved with some of Trump's former political allies, repelling career prosecutors from those cases, in one case leading them to leave the department altogether. Barr went on CNN and sort of huffed and puffed about backing the president's concerns about fraud. Barr was so brazenly willing to put his thumbs on the scale for Trump's political allies, this being a weird mix of sort of a one-time ally turned truth teller and critic at the time of the president, ex-president's impeachment. I wonder, I just want to come back to this idea of, you know, as we're beginning to have this reveal of what really went on at the Trump era Justice Department, what are your concerns, Frank, about what was done to people higher up on the enemies list, people like Adam Schiff?
I think we're only just beginning to learn the depth of what was done outside the processes. And that I think is a major factor in how DOJ is assessing all of this. Was there something that was extra procedural outside the typical process or not? And that's what we call in the investigation business a clue. So for example, in the Bolton case, as you've now clearly stated, he went through the pre-publication review. I've been through that process myself with my own book, and it can be arduous and it can take months. But when you're done, you're done. And the White House was satisfied, and he was told that by a career professional. So here's the clue. As soon as a professional tells you, yep, we're done, you're good to go, but I got to just pass it by this guy over here, and then all hell breaks loose and you're told you can't publish, that's the clue that we're now outside the process. And so I think that's what Merrick Garland's DOJ is looking at. But at the real heart of this question is the question of accountability, because we're going to keep finding this stuff out. And in the Bolton example, we're going to find out that someone at the White House grabbed it away from the career professionals and made stuff up about classification levels. Someone at DOJ went along with the filing of a criminal investigation. What about that is going to lead to accountability? That's my concern. That's my question. Because the message has to be sent that this is not established precedent anymore. We're not doing this anymore. And the only way you counter that precedent that's been set is to hold people accountable. I still don't really see that. Can John Bolton personally sue these people because they were outside the scope of their employment? Could DOJ said these people were not operating within our norms and regulations? They're outside the scope. You can go after them personally. Very, very difficult to do.
Charlie Sykes, I'm thinking of this really important point Frank just made. A career national security official did her job. She reviewed the transcript. She found classified information. The manuscript went through the process of removing all of that. I worked in the Bush White House. There were a lot of books. I can't think of any that weren't scathing about the Bush years. They went through this process, and there was never an effort to stop them from being published. The goal is to stop classified information from being revealed in any book, in any manuscript. This, to me, is the story of the subversion of the career officials who did their jobs. This official, she read Bolton's book. She found classified stuff. She had Bolton take it out. Bolton took it out. He submitted it again. It had no classified stuff. She stamps it. Then it gets perverted. And we heard Bill Barr in his own words. He gave a speech. He called career officials at DOJ preschoolers, said it was like letting a Montessori room run the Justice Department. He would never leave it to them. How much of this is about, and you think of Colonel Vindman. I mean, you could go to Marie Yovanovitch. You could go to Fiona Hill. I mean, career professionals, subject matter professionals were constantly abused and subverted by the likes of Bill Barr and Donald Trump.
No, that's exactly right. And I think you need to pull back the frame a little bit. This is really not about John Bolton, but look at what we had witnessed. We saw 4 years of a cover up and stonewalling in real time, in broad daylight. This was an administration that did not want to be held accountable, that was withholding information from Congress, that in fact refused to cooperate, and then tried to silence, and if they could not silence, intimidate, and then discredit whistleblowers, internal critics. This was the norm. This was the policy of the administration, and it flowed right from the Oval Office, which again, this ought to be an occasion not just for congressional investigations, but for serious considerations by Congress about how it can strengthen the protections for whistleblowers, but also its ability to investigate the executive branch without violating any constitutional separation of power. But again, this was, we talked a lot about the breaking of norms and everything, and maybe it became same old after a while. But we're now really seeing, you know, how it worked in this administration. And just the one thought that I can't shake is what a second Trump administration would have been like if he had someone like Bill Barr as Attorney General, or somebody even worse than Bill Barr. Because if there is a second Trump administration, you know that this will be one of his priorities, and that he will find somebody even worse than Bill Barr, who will reward his friends, protect his friends, pardon his friends, obstruct justice, stonewall, and then harass and threaten his critics. Because I mean, that is the way this administration did business.
Sure thing. I think those are, I think that's so important. This is not about John Bolton. This is about the career official whose professionalism was subverted by Trump and Bill Barr. It's a great point. Mike Schmidt, thank you for joining us with your reporting on this fascinating breaking news story. Frank Figluzzi and Charlie Sykes are sticking around a little longer with us, because up next, the dangerous reality that some in this country are unable to admit, that January 6th was what it was, an insurrection.
I think this is a new low for this crowd. They now are part of the insurrectionist mob. They brought enormous disrepute and dishonor on themselves in not honoring the brave men and women who defended the Capitol of the United States, everybody in it, but also defending the symbol of democracy in the world, not just here in the United States. Shameful moment.
Shameful is one way to describe what happened yesterday. Disgraceful works pretty well, too. We'll start with the good. The House yesterday passed a bill to award congressional gold medals to honor those who protected the seat of our American democracy from armed insurrectionists in January. 406 American lawmakers voted in favor of the legislation. But again, shamefully, 21 lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, did not. These are their names on your screen. One of them is named Paul Gosar. He's called the insurrectionists, quote, peaceful patriots. And he spent the rest of his Tuesday grilling FBI Director Christopher Wray over the identity of the officer who fatally shot a woman trying to leap through a Capitol window. Gosar said, without evidence, that officers were lying in wait for her, that it was an execution. It's a distortion of events, part of a larger Republican effort to dramatically whitewash the events of January 6th. Joining our conversation, NBC4 Washington correspondent Scott McFarlane, Frank Figluzzi, and Charlie Sykes are also with us. Scott, tell me about the reaction to this not being a unanimous vote to reward the men and women who gave with their bodies so that American lawmakers didn't give with theirs.
Nicole, there was a lot of frustration, but not a lot of surprise. Among those 21 names, some of Donald Trump's most ardent supporters, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, as you mentioned, Paul Gosar. But I spoke to another one of those 21, Dr. Andy Harris, the only Republican in the delegation from Maryland. His statement was, this otherwise commendable resolution was hijacked by Speaker Pelosi to continue pushing her claims January 6th was an armed insurrection. What's important that you know is in the written statement Harris gave me, he put quotes around the word insurrection. So there is this caucus that has formed that seems to vote against all things January 6th, even what seems, Nicole, to be non-controversial.
Charlie Sykes, we're not the only ones calling BS on the insurrection caucus. Liz Cheney is doing it as well, as is Adam Kinzinger. Yeah. These are their tweets. Kinzinger first. You're sick, Paul, sadly. Truth is, Ashley was manipulated by people like you and breached an area and put lives in danger, despite being repeatedly warned not to. The real criminals are the liars abusing people for political power. Cheney adds this, on January 6th, as the violent mob advanced on the House chamber, I was standing near Gosar. I helped him open his gas mask. The Capitol Police led us to safety. It is disgusting and despicable to see Gosar lie about that day and smear the men and women who defended us.
Yeah, I'm glad that they're pushing back on all of this. Look, there is no bottom for these folks. And, you know, you use the term whitewash. I think we almost need to come up with a stronger term for what's happening. This historical revisionism, this retconning of what happened. And you know, on the right, you have all of these multiple narratives that, no, it was not an insurrection. It was a peaceful protest. They were just tourists. Okay, well, it was a peaceful protest and there were a few knuckleheads. No, it was a violent insurrection, but it was Antifa. Right. You know, it was an insurrection, but it was, you know, brave patriots. And now they're moving to, you know, suggest that maybe it was a false flag operation that was designed by the FBI. I mean, the dishonesty mingles with the crazy here. But the overall theme is to try to make people forget and downplay what happened and what we saw in real time with our own eyes. And it is interesting that this sedition caucus would go so far as to vote against this resolution, which shows you how this has become a litmus test on the Trumpian right, at least in elements of the Trumpian right, that you have to deny not just the reality of the insurrection, but you have to deny the heroism of the men and women in blue who laid their lives on the line. And we ought to at least underline the irony here. This is a party that claims that blue lives matter and that has wrapped itself in pro-police rhetoric and symbolism. And yet when it comes down to this particular moment, they are not willing to stand with the men and women in uniform who laid their lives down to protect a temple of democracy.
And Frank, you know that they know it's BS as well. And they're doing exactly what Kinzinger and Cheney say they're doing. They're lying to their supporters. If they actually thought there were any chance that as the facts were revealed, they would reveal that Antifa had anything to do with this or the FBI, why wouldn't they be the ones pushing for a commission to investigate?
Yeah, this is about preservation of power. They're going to do whatever they need to do to get reelected, stay in power, and stick with a base as long as Trump remains the primary influencer over their party. That's simply what's going to happen. Look, I can't, from my national security perspective, I can't let this opportunity go to not point out that as recently as today, Vladimir Putin at his press conference regurgitated the very same message that we have U.S. congressmen sending, which is that the people that breached the security at the Capitol were simply looking for their political voice. They were simply looking for some political solutions. Vladimir Putin said that today at his press conference, and these members of Congress who refused to honor for bravery the Capitol police officers who protected those members of Congress are echoing the same thing as Putin. It's becoming difficult to understand the difference between whether it's the message started in Moscow or the message is coming from the GOP, but it is one and the same. And isn't it interesting, Nicole, that the very same members of Congress who will look the other way when a police officer is accused of brutally beating or murdering a black person through excessive use of force and will vote against any attempt at police reform will immediately call it an execution if a police officer protecting the democratic symbol of our country has to use deadly force against a white domestic terrorist. Seems something is incongruous there.
Well, and it's beyond incongruous and hypocritical, and Charlie used the word ironic. I mean, let me ask you, Scott, I mean, do the law enforcement officials themselves have any theory on why the Republicans don't want to award them for sacrificing their bodies? One was mutilated with a flagpole, another lost a finger, people had heart attacks and were tased. I mean, why do they think 21 Republicans didn't think they were worthy of any sort of award for bravery and sacrifice?
It's a great question. The officers who are speaking out, including injured D.C. officer Michael Fanone, are very much questioning how this is possible, how any member of Congress can question what happened that day or the violence of what happened that day. But here's a point to add to what Frank said. Some of this is manifesting itself in the criminal cases. Just today, a defendant named Stephen Randolph of Kentucky was allowed free from jail by the judge. His attorney repeatedly kept calling it the January 6th event, almost caught herself from saying insurrection, using the phrase event to paraphrase what actually happened that day. Ultimately, that was part of a successful argument. She secured his release till trial.
It's amazing. Scott, thank you so much for staying on this story and for spending time with us, bringing us your great reporting.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
I want to turn now to the pressure building on the ex-president through the investigations based in New York. Donald Trump's longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, could be facing charges as soon as this summer. People with knowledge of the matter are telling the New York Times that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office appears to have entered the final stages of a criminal tax investigation into Weisselberg. Prosecutors are investigating whether he failed to pay taxes on thousands of dollars of benefits Trump provided to him and his family over the years. New York Times reports that prosecutors have obtained Mr. Weisselberg's personal tax returns, providing the fullest picture yet of his finances. We're back with Frank Figlizzi and Charlie Sykes. Frank, I want your sort of view from an investigative standpoint. Is this about charging Weisselberg, or is this about maybe running up against a brick wall in terms of getting him to cooperate? So once you've been charged with whatever counts of felony tax fraud, perhaps you're more cooperative.
Yeah, this could be a little bit of both. And here's what I mean by that. The fact that the reporting's indicating that they're getting closer and closer to an indictment, and perhaps even in the weeks or months ahead, is a clue that they haven't gotten him cooperating yet. I mean, he just didn't roll over. He didn't, you know, he didn't say, yeah, you got me. Don't, let's not even continue with this grand jury. That's one thing. But it is not at all unusual to have to go through the drill of getting that grand jury indictment. Sometimes potential cooperators, until you show them that indictment and say, it's over, we're going to trial on this. Sometimes you don't get the cooperation. And by the way, sometimes you have to go to trial until they realize, my Lord, I've lost the jury. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cooperate now. So they're going all the way on this. The irony of this is, what are they primarily looking at Weisselberg for in his personal taxes? It's the very stuff he got, the fancy Mercedes cars, the fancy school tuition from Trump to remain quiet and keep his loyalty to Trump. That's what they're looking at in terms of not properly claiming that on his taxes. There's tremendous irony there.
Yeah. I mean, Charlie's got the word of the, I mean, the irony that the stuff that was given to Weisselberg to keep him quiet about the stuff Weisselberg did for Trump and that Trump did, the fraud that Michael Cohen has testified before Congress to, is the very stuff that could send Weisselberg to jail for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, we'll see whether he flips. Look, I was on your show some years ago, and I was completely wrong. I said there's no way that Michael Cohen is ever going to flip on Donald Trump because he was the ultimate loyalist. But you never know. There's something clarifying about facing a federal indictment, especially when they have all the records. Look, I mean, the one thing that we're realizing is that, you know, the Trump organization, you know, has never been subjected to anything like this kind of scrutiny. And the prosecutors have all the crown jewels. They don't just have the tax returns. They have the financial records. And with Weisselberg, they would get, you know, the man who knows where every single body is buried. So there's going to be tremendous pressure on him, obviously, to not break. But look, if the prosecutors have him and they have members of their family, this is the way you put together. This is the way you bring down crime families. You find the people who, you know where all of this stuff is, and you put the squeeze on them. So, again, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves on this because we've seen Donald Trump skate on one thing after another. But if you're Donald Trump, you cannot be happy about the fact that they are zoning in on this guy because you know that he knows absolutely everything.
Charlie, I had the same feelings about Michael Cohen. I remember his campaign era interviews and you know, Trump puts people in extraordinary situations. Frank Peduzzi, Charlie Sykes, thank you for spending the whole hour with us and twisting and turning with all of our breaking news. It's great to have both of you. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a very short break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
Sadly, what we've seen over the last 4 years, and particularly since our election in 2020, is that we have people within our own country who are doing Putin's work. Now, whether they are, as we say, witting or unwitting, they are doing his work to sow distrust, to sow divisiveness, to give aid and comfort to those within our country who, for whatever reason, are being not only disruptive, but very dangerous.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in the East. Not only does President Biden have to contend with his Russian counterpart on the world stage, but America's doing a fine job from within its own borders of advancing Putin's message. We saw that on full display today when the Russian president was asked about the treatment of his opponents in Russia and answered with an attack on the political divisions in the U.S., pointing specifically to January 6th.
If all of your political opponents are dead in prison, poison, doesn't that send a message that you do not want a fair political fight?
As for who is killing whom or throwing whom in jail, people came to the U.S. Congress with political demands. 400 people. Over 400 people had criminal charges placed on them. They face prison sentences of up to 20, maybe even 25 years. They're being called domestic terrorists. They're being accused of a number of other crimes. Some people died, and one of the people that died, they were simply shot on the spot by the police, although they were not threatening the police with any weapons. In many countries, the same thing happens that happens in our country. I'd like to stress once more that we sympathize with what happened in the United States, but we have no desire to allow the same thing to happen in our country.
In his press conference that followed that, President Biden responded.
I think that's a ridiculous comparison. It's one thing for literally criminals to break through cordon, go into the Capitol, kill a police officer, and be held unaccountable. And it is for people objecting and marching on the Capitol and saying, you are not allowing me to speak freely. You are not allowing me to do A, B, C, or D. And so they're very different criteria.
Putin's use of January 6th to justify his own policies toward dissidents was something we also saw last week in an interview with our colleague Keir Simmons. And what was more frightening than his weaponizing America's political divisions was how that narrative was then received, heard, agreed with, I guess, and parroted back to us by right-wing media here in the United States. Last night, Fox News' Tucker Carlson said that when Putin raises Ashley Babbitt's death, he raises, quote, fair questions. Carlson also brought 1/6 trutherism to new heights or lows, positing that some who attacked the Capitol that day were working for the FBI, that the siege was orchestrated by the FBI to, quote, suppress political dissent. Carlson's outrageous claim, just the latest from Trump's allies trying to deny or shift blame for the deadly insurrection, as well as being the latest example of the right being in lockstep with Putin's messages. President Biden having to grapple with a party that was traditionally harsh on Russia, but has now evolved or devolved to spreading the same talking points we hear from the Russian president, is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. NBC News senior international correspondent Keir Simmons is live in Moscow with us. Also joining us, Rick Stengel, former top State Department official and former member of President Biden's transition. And Pete Strux here, former FBI counterintelligence agent and author of the book Compromise. I can't wait to ask you about this new theory about the FBI being behind the insurrection. But I do want to start with President Biden's performance today with you, Rick Stengel.
Yes, I thought it was a strong performance. Maybe I'm sentimental, but when an American president talks about values, talks about how representing the American people, I have to bring up the human rights of people because we believe in that. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That's powerful to me. I don't think Donald Trump ever talked about values except when he was overinflating the values of an apartment building. So I think Biden also showed us that this is a practical matter. I really think, and I don't have this from anybody except my own imagination, that hey, look, we have big problems at home. We have COVID. We are dealing with China. Russia is a disruptor. Let's make Putin kind of more reasonable and more predictable. And by recognizing him on the world stage, he's doing that. I mean, U.S.-Russia relations have been along a continuum for, you know, practically all of our history between the folks who think you got to crack down on the Russians because that's the only thing they understand, to those people who say, hey, we have to recognize them as a world power. If they feel a little more self-esteem, they won't be so disruptive. And in a way, Biden navigated those two things. He recognized Putin as a leader on the world stage, stood toe to toe with him. But then he also said, look, there are going to be consequences for your actions. I mean, the carrot was the meeting and the stick was saying, look, you know, Mr. Putin, you understand we have these capabilities, too. That's all he had to say.
Keir, I want to come back to you. Your interview did more than raise the curtain on what Putin was going to say, this whataboutism that you and I talked about earlier this week. But I wonder if his really taking up for the insurrectionists and really aligning himself with the American right is something that is part of a long-term strategy. Is it a one-off? Is it how he's going to sort of endure the non-Trump years?
It's a great question because we've talked about Russian election meddling as trying to kind of lean into the divisions in the US. You don't really need to look at election meddling back in 2016 to see it, do you? You can just look at what President Putin has to say. I mean, look, you know, Nicole, I feel like the big question coming out of all this is, will President Biden's combination of warnings and a personal touch have a real effect on the Kremlin? This is an imperfect analogy, and I suspect you being such a lovely person, you very likely didn't have any issues in high school. For those of us who can't say that, the rule was always, if someone was going to get into a fight, then they needed to show that they cared less than the other guy about getting hurt, and that they were prepared to do more damage. And I think the question with President Biden is, was he able to give President Putin that impression? What worries me is that I think the US still gives Russia the impression that, frankly, it has more to lose in the fight than Russia does. And that actually, with cyber, could be argued is true. I suspect those threats that you heard President Biden make to President Putin, the question in President Putin's mind will be, will America really go through with it? Because, of course, the issue with cyber is the escalation. So, you know, clearly the US, and I said this to President Putin in the interview, do you fear that America has the ability that is dug in enough to your systems to do damage? He said, yeah, I don't fear it, but I suspect it. But the question for President Putin will be, will America really do that? Because in Washington, every time you take another step to show Russia how you can retaliate, you risk escalation. It's that sense with Putin that he just doesn't care. As long as he gets his time on the world stage, that's the piece I think that needs to be tackled. Until it's tackled, you may not change his behavior.
I want to just briefly address Kira's assumptions about me. I was so wayward, I was shipped off to another country way ahead of the normal year abroad. That we'll save that for another conversation. I like the analogy. Pete Stark, I want to dig into this idea. I mean, Putin, I think what Kira's saying is that Putin wins either way, basically, in Putin world, because he is an autocrat. I don't know that we've sort of, the last three, four American presidents, had a summit with an American president and an autocratic one where half the country is rooting for the autocrat. And I wonder, since there's an intersection now between the threats to the homeland here and an intersection to the ideology being advanced and parroted, and it's unclear now whether it starts from Putin and ends with Tucker or starts with Tucker and ends with Putin, what is sort of the national security picture when that's the dynamic?
Well, I think Putin clearly understands that he has found a fault line in American society, and he is placing his weight as best he can to stir up the antagonisms between the various political forces in the United States. The staggering thing, Nicole, is just yesterday, there was a congressman who asked FBI Director Chris Wray who Ashley Babbitt's executioner was. And that is literally the same words coming in questions coming out of Putin's mouth today. So any viewer, not only your viewers, but any American who's looking at this saying, why are these extreme members of the Republican Party in Congress mimicking and parroting the same things we are hearing out of a very antagonistic Vladimir Putin? That's a question every American should be asking themselves. But Putin knows full well what he's doing. I agree with some of the analysis that this is all giving a platform to Putin. It is giving legitimacy to him and giving him a place on the world stage that he might not otherwise have. But the counter to that is this does present the opportunity to make points about Alexei Navalny, to make points about human rights in Russia, to have just fantastic American journalistic work asking him and holding him to account about why each and every one of his opponents seems to fall out of a window or end up dead. There are advantages to this dialogue in terms of hopefully bringing Russia towards a more democratic political process.
You know, I had this thought, Rick Stengel, I mean, to Pete's point, he was humiliated by these reporters because what she's saying is, are you so politically impotent and weak that you can't win with your dissidents and political detractors roaming free? You have to have them in jail and poisoned. And in some ways, that was a more brutal slap in the face than anything that can happen in the diplomatic sphere.
I agree. And let's be honest about this now, right? Russia has an economy the size of Italy. The economy of Texas is bigger than Russia's. Now that we can travel this summer, are we all going to Sochi and Leningrad and Moscow? I don't think so. You know, their biggest export is oil and vodka and their own people. When a country's biggest export is its own people, they're not doing anything right. The population is stagnant. The oil industry is not going to exist 25 years from now. I mean, Russia is in a corner, and Putin is an upstart in the sense that he wants to muscle his way onto the world stage and get attention and to say, hey, look at me, I'm equal to the big guys. And of course, that's what the perception in Russia is, that Russia is back. But it's an illusion. And there's no one around the world who thinks that. And by the way, I thought Biden was smart to point out the fact that, look, Putin cares about his reputation around the world. When you know, as big countries are not supposed to lie, as he once said. So by putting Putin in that spot, by being questioned by American reporters like that, I think it hurts the public diplomacy and the prestige of Moscow. And I think that's what Putin cares about.
Yeah, Keir, did you get any sense from your interview or from anything you saw today about what happens next? I mean, this idea that Putin is either too powerless over crimes in Russia to control, I mean, we talked about this early in the week, to control the attacks on our meat supply and our gas supply isn't really plausible. But do you think he goes back and tries to tighten his control of the cyber criminals in his own country? Do you think he wants to have more, I guess control is the right word, control over when and where those attacks happen?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that he does. I think he goes back and concludes, honestly, that his strategy of threaten, attack, deny, negotiate, threaten, attack, deny, negotiate, that's kind of working. And I think cyber is part of that. Look, there was someone in the Russian delegation, General Gerasimov, who is the author of the idea of hybrid warfare in Russia. And what you're talking about with the propaganda side, if you like, connecting with the divisions in America, that is part of the hybrid warfare strategy. You know, what effectively that strategy is actually recognizing that the US is more powerful, but using kind of, you know, underhand tactics in all kinds of ways. You can see it, for example, just in Ukraine, in order to get advantage despite your inherent disadvantage, you know. And it goes back to the same point that I made, which is it's about recognizing that if you got into a full-scale war, if you like, you'd lose. So don't do that. Push it to the edge, push it to the edge. Again, the issue, I suspect, with President Putin is if you can give him the impression that he can't push because actually he'll get really damaged, that may be a, kind of the leverage that the US needs. My question today is, did President Biden manage to communicate that effectively enough to President Putin?
Yeah, I mean, this idea of leverage, to me, Pete Strzok, makes me wonder what I'm not seeing. I mean, if you look at what Putin achieved in 16, there was, I mean, the Mueller report bore out, there was a match of mission between what the Russians were doing and what the Trump campaign was doing, if not a criminal conspiracy. He became more audacious in 2020 and was funneling Russian disinformation through Ukrainian actors straight to Donald Trump's personal criminal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, they seem to be getting more advanced. The cyber attacks are coming at a quicker clip. There was one during this chaotic, abbreviated transition on the executive branch. Two more in the first 100 days of the Biden presidency. I mean, are we winning?
I don't know. I'm very interested to see what the administration does when inevitably I think we will see more ransomware attacks. I would not be surprised to see if we see aggressive and effective intrusions into our government and other computer systems. So I have no doubt that it's going to continue. And I'm certain that the Biden administration has come up with policy options about how to respond. I suspect the most powerful and effective tools will be those that seize or somehow go after the money of Putin and those of the ruling class around him. But it's anybody's guess as to whether or not that's going to be effective. Because as you point out, they did it quite a bit over the past 4 years. If anything, it increased. We see a massive harboring of criminal elements within Russia, whose only rules seem to be don't attack Russian or former Soviet states, otherwise we'll provide you safe harbor. So all these questions are going to very quickly come to a head, I suspect, and we'll see what the Biden administration does to respond to it and whether or not it's effective. But we're going to see that, and we're going to see, or at least some of the response of what happens after the Russians do that, I'm convinced.
Pete Strzok, what happens inside the FBI, inside all the field offices, when the most popular anchor on Fox News accuses the FBI of running an operation to attack the United States Capitol on January 6th?
Well, I think, unfortunately, we've gotten to the place where hearing something like that, which is so outrageous, is unfortunately no longer surprising. I mean, it's been the steady drumbeat of increasing craziness coming out of a lot of the, you know, the Fox and extreme right-wing media. But look, it's a crazy assertion. It strikes me as the sort of story that, you know, these crazy views that 9/11 was an inside job, that somehow the government was behind that. Right. And, you know, in the best traditions of the, you know, the wild conspiracy theories about JFK's assassination. Plainly put, there is no way the FBI or anybody else in the government was behind some organized effort to participate in the January 6th insurrection. And for a mainstream media personality like Tucker Carlson to go out and babble on this craziness is really disappointing. I don't think most FBI agents and investigators pay it much mind, but it is, you know, disappointing to the extent that a significant amount of the American population continues to watch Fox News to give it some sort of credence. And, I don't know what it's going to take to get it to stop, but it does need to stop. People need to grow up and people need to start telling the truth, or at least some vague semblance of it, instead of this wild, outrageous conspiracy.
Is it dangerous? Does it endanger the safety of FBI agents, Pete?
Of course it does. I mean, it is dangerous in that it is being listened to by a group of people who are in some cases becoming increasingly radicalized and violent. It is dangerous in the sense that people listening to it, even if they're not prone to violence, may not be inclined to work with the FBI if somebody comes to their door and asks for their help. This is just the further degradation and the corrosion of what is happening to not only the FBI, but just generally the government. There is a important mission of U.S. federal law enforcement and U.S. intelligence to keep America safe, to look after the national security of the United States. And when you have this utterly false, reprehensible sort of babble coming out of Fox News, that hurts the United States because it damages all of these various components of the U.S. government. And it does. It makes us less safe.
It's just an unbelievable moment. I'm grateful to talk to all of you about it. NBC's Keir Simmons live for us in Moscow. Thank you so much for your extraordinary reporting all week long. Richard Stengel and Pete Strzok, thank you for starting us off this hour. When we return, there was one moment of tension at President Biden's press conference today in Geneva. Up next, we'll ask one of the president's closest allies and confidants in the U.S. Senate all about it. Plus, the absolute subversion of democracy under the disgraced ex-president and the pressure campaign he and his allies mounted against the U.S. attorney in Atlanta who refused to go along with it, and The Atlantic's George Packer, author of a profound new book about how America hasn't fractured into two separate countries but four, and the great reckoning facing the country in a post-Trump, increasingly post-COVID era. It is stunning. He will join us later in the hour to talk about it. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
I pointed out to him we have significant cyber capability, and he knows it. He doesn't know exactly what it is, but it's significant. And if, in fact, they violate these basic norms, we will respond. Cyber. He knows in the cyber way.
Joining us now, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. He's a member of the Foreign Relations and Judiciary Committees, and equally importantly, one of President Biden's closest allies. From his days in the Senate and as vice president and as president. And I wonder what you thought of your friend and our president on the world stage this week.
Nicole, I think President Biden did what he went to do, did what he needed to do. And I think what's unfolded today in Geneva shows us why we want a president with real experience. He's been preparing for today for 40 years. More importantly, he prepared all last week, the last week that he has spent in Western Europe with our closest allies, getting the wind behind his back so that he could go into the meeting with Vladimir Putin of Russia strong, with a clear message and a clear agenda.
What is the prospect of our country's ability to stop the cyber attacks that we've endured just since January? The first one that we knew about on the executive branch during that messy transition, the second one on the gas supply for the eastern U.S., and the third on our meat supply.
Well, frankly, going back to the 2016 election, when there was robust Russian interference in our domestic elections, we have needed to send a stronger, clearer message. And as President Biden just said in the clip that you showed a few moments ago, we have significant capabilities, both defensive and offensive, in the cyber realm that may well need to be deployed to push back hard on Russia. The SolarWinds hack that you're referencing, the ransomware attacks that were criminal but seem to have originated in Russia, both are very pointed, painful, recent reminders of the ways in which Putin and Putin's Russia are only going to stop when we stop them. And they've imposed similar costs, similar interference, both in elections and in the economy across many other Western and Central European countries. So we'd have the enthusiastic support of many of our allies in Europe if we did something in the cyber realm that was the equivalent of punching them in the nose or pushing them back to make it clear to Russia, we know what they're doing and we're not going to tolerate it.
It's interesting that you raised the election attack in 2016. It's unfortunately not received a ton of attention today. I've watched a good bit of TV, but this was the first president who went in and seriously confronted Putin about it. I don't know if you remember that strange press avail with Trump and Putin, where a press person said to Trump, did you press him about election interference? He said, I press you about election interference. He basically did it as a joke because a reporter asked in front of the cameras. This was a president not just pressing Putin about election interference, but about election interference that sought to smear him and his family, that was so brazen it ran through a sitting U.S. senator, it ran through Rudy Giuliani, it ran through the whole apparatus of right-wing media. What do you think that was like for this president?
What do I think it was like for President Biden to have to endure those unjustified smears on his family? What do I think it was like today when he sat down with Vladimir Putin and said, I see you and I know what you did? President Biden, as senator and as vice president, had lots of experience sitting across the table from folks who needed to get a tough message from the United States. I'm confident he delivered one today. And I think the impact that it had on him personally may have given it just that extra little edge that's needed for it to be heard, believed, and responded to appropriately. But as we both know, I think we're talking about the same press conference. It was at the event in Helsinki that our friend, the late Senator John McCain, said it was just an appalling failure of leadership by President Trump to not strongly stand up for our democracy, to not call out Putin for his interference in our elections. I think, as you pointed out, President Biden knows full well what that kind of election interference, a disinformation campaign can lead to. And it's far past time, it's long past time for us to send an effective and strong signal to Putin to cut it out.
I don't want to make too much of this, but I just want to show you sort of a display of emotion, an exchange with a reporter that ended in an apology and the reporter thanking the president for the apology. But let's just talk me through this. Let me show it first. We'll talk about it on the other side.
Why are you so confident he'll change his behavior, Mr. President?
I'm not confident he'll change his behavior. What the hell? What do you do all the time?
So
when did I say I was confident?
I said,
let's get it straight. I said what will change their behavior is if the rest of the world reacts to them and it diminishes their standing in the world. I'm not confident of anything. I'm just stating the fact.
The president went out of his way to apologize. That was Caitlin Collins, a reporter for CNN. He said, quote, I owe my last questioner an apology. I shouldn't have been such a wise guy with the last answer I gave. She then responded, I just want to give our viewers the whole string of events here. Caitlin Collins then said, quote, he did not have to apologize, though I do appreciate that. Adding that asking the president a question does not mean it has a negative slant or a positive slant. This seems like if you know President Biden, you know the different sides of him coming back and sort of defending his position. But it also is so different to sort of come out and say, I was too hot and apologize moments later.
Absolutely. One of the things I have always respected about President Biden is that he treats people with kindness, with decency, with respect. He knew that it had been a long meeting. He'd had hours. He'd done a long press conference. And as he was walking off, that hit him the wrong way. And he came back and gave a somewhat sharp retort. But frankly, I think he was clarifying his statement in a not inappropriate way. But if you contrast his actions with his predecessor in terms of then promptly apologizing to the reporter and saying, you know, maybe I was just a little too hot. I just think that is yet another demonstration of Joe's basic decency, excuse me, of President Biden's basic normalcy, his kindness. He knows when maybe he's been just a little sharper than he needed to. And I think this simple sign of respect and decency towards our press is particularly important. We live in a world where the press is under assault in so many ways across so many countries, and we all know that in Russia, press freedom is under sustained and aggressive assault, and there are many ways in which, under the previous administration, there was a combative and hostile and sometimes personally critical relationship with the press. President Biden is trying to show a different approach and a different standard. And I think today he made the right decision in having a separate press briefing after the hours-long meeting with President Putin in order to not give President Putin a chance to put his own spin on it or to say things that didn't actually happen in the meeting, as did occur in previous summits. So I think President Biden handled himself very well and once again showed his basic decency.
Senator Chris Coons, it's always great to talk to you, especially on a day like today. Thank you for making some time to talk to us today.
Thanks.
When we return, as part of the former guy's efforts to enlist the Justice Department to overturn an election he lost, new details are emerging about the pressure campaign waged against the top federal prosecutor in Atlanta, who resigned abruptly in January and refused to go along with it. That story is next. It has been something of a mystery. Why did Atlanta-based U.S. Attorney BJ Pack abruptly resign in early January, just weeks before his scheduled retirement? From the moment it happened, really, amid the Trump administration's quest to overturn the results of the election he lost, there have been context clues, theories, and reports from unnamed sources. But today, new documents released by House Democrats are filling in some of the blanks, illustrating the considerable pressure Pack was under and suggesting the Department of Justice had honed in on him as a potential avenue for disputing President Biden's win in Georgia. From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, "The House Oversight Committee wants Pack and other former Trump administration officials who sent the messages to come in for questioning." Pack told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution he plans to do so. Let's bring into our conversation Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney and an MSNBC contributor. So, Tia, did you have, I mean, what was the sense at the time, and is there relief now that he can tell the truth about what was going on?
I think there are still a lot of unanswered questions. You know, what we still don't know is what that conversation that then U.S. Attorney Pack had with his superior that led to his resignation the next morning. So there are a lot of blanks that he could fill in if and when he does meet with the oversight committee. But, you know, what we learned yesterday did help fill in some of those blanks and kind of made it clearer that Pack did resign under some pressure.
Tia, what's your number one question if you were on the committee?
My number one question would be what that conversation was Sunday night, and what other conversations did he have with Department of Justice officials between, you know, probably late December, early January? And did Attorney Pack feel pressure to try to investigate the Fulton County election results and possibly, you know, try to, quote unquote, find more votes for President Trump?
You know, Joyce, it just strikes me that with the revelations that the New York Times, CNN, The Washington Post, Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, Don McGahn were spied on by the Trump era DOJ, that Mark Meadows sent multiple emails asking them to overturn the election, that Donald Trump, through a personal assistant, sent an email to the acting attorney general asking them to overturn the election result in six cases. Understanding what all the U.S. attorneys are being asked to do between the election and the inauguration of Joe Biden is of vital importance, is it not?
I think you're dead on the money. This is almost the last piece of the puzzle that falls into place. We see the pressure at other levels. Here in Atlanta, and the Fulton County election results were obviously under attack. They were under attack by the Trump administration. The district attorney there has an open case on this call to the Secretary of State, where Trump tried to get them to fraudulently create enough votes for him to win the election. So in addition to U.S. Attorney Pack, who was forced out by all accounts, it would be great if the Oversight Committee would call the U.S. Attorney in Savannah and get his testimony on the phone calls that he had with folks in DOJ. What led him to jump in his car and drive up to Atlanta with two election experts in tow? That, too, is a piece of the puzzle. And I think U.S. attorneys in all of these areas where there were contested elections need to be questioned under oath about what communications they had with the department's top leadership.
And do you see that, Joyce, as an extension of the Judiciary Committee work, or is that need to be part of a larger January 6th investigation?
That, too, is a really good question. As long as the House Oversight Committee is focused on this and is getting people to come in to testify, it seems like that's a really good place to start. But there is a larger question here about resolving the entirety of whether the president went beyond simple statements, according to him, on the ellipse on January 6th, or whether there was a real sustained effort here to pressure state mechanisms using DOJ's official resources to overturn the outcome of the election.
And we learned just this week that he personally tried to use DOJ's resources through his assistant, emailing Acting Attorney General Rosen. It's an unbelievable chapter of all this. I'm really grateful to get to talk to both of you. Tia Mitchell, Joyce Vance, thank you so much. When we return, our next guest argues that America has become the kind of country we used to think we could save. As we move into a post-Trump, post-COVID world, what will it take for our highly divided country to come together again? The author George Packer joins us after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. In post-Trump and increasingly post-COVID America, we are given or forced into a rare chance to take a hard look at who we are. A democracy fragile and unrecognizable, emerging from a pandemic both made an incalculable amount worse by the disgraced ex-president. George Packer marks this moment in his new book, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. He says the key to saving our self-governing nation is equality and the ability to argue and compromise, a near impossible task for a fractured country, torn and lived along party lines, no longer united in a shared purpose or values. Packer writes this, quote, "When I say last best hope, don't misunderstand me. America is no longer a light unto the nations. It was always a role that made us appear better and worse than we were. What do we see in the mirror now? An unstable country, political institutions that might not be perpetuated, a people divided into warring tribes and prone to violence, the kind of country we used to think we could save. Before life starts up again, we have a moment to ask ourselves, with all our divisions, what do we have in common? Is there some underlying adhesive that can make us one country again?" Joining us now is George Packer, staff writer for The Atlantic and author of the new book, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. You know, I'm such a fan of everything you write. I read this book in two sittings and it's exquisitely written, but very haunting. Just talk about it a little bit. And I want to read some of the things that stuck out most for me, but I want to hear from you first.
Well, thank you, Nicole, and it's good to be with you again. This was a COVID book. I started it right before the election. It was a period of dread. There were wildfires, there were storms, and there was the threat of violence and of an election that would break us into two. People were arming up. And there was also the protests and the pandemic itself that was still killing thousands of people pretty much daily. So I wrote it in a state of dread, but by the time I finished, the election was over, Joe Biden was president, the vaccine was being distributed. It felt as if there was some hope, and I had also written myself into a state of very cautious hope about the country by looking to some degree at our history and trying to find some national identity that we can fall back on. We're so divided, and in the book I described four different narratives that divide us. But I do think there is a national identity. I think it comes down to the word equality, which has been the driving passion for Americans from the beginning, which has always eluded us as a country, but which has always motivated people to improve the country. And that's still true today.
I'm going to read your four Americas. There's Free America, Reagan's America, Libertarian America, Personal Freedom Without Other People, Imagines a Nation of Separate Individuals and Serves the Interests of Corporations and the Wealthy. There's Real America, the Narrative of Real America, is White Christian Nationalism, personified by Sarah Palin. Smart America, the professional, the educated, they believe in talents and credentials, but they become a class where you're just born into it without really getting tested. Just America, the millennial generation who says the country is not progressing. It's a caste system with certain groups oppressing other groups. Talk about, I mean, when you talk about how we, and I imagine where you found your hope, is the idea to knit ourselves back together. Which group is most likely to start trusting the other first?
There's too much mistrust to imagine that one group can do it. For example, Real America and Free America kind of come out of a similar political side, the Republican Party, but they're at war with each other. The Trump spirit of the Republican Party against the elites, against Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. Smart and Just America. Just America is a rebellion of the young against their parents, their meritocratic parents. So Red and Blue America divide us, but within each of those, we're further divided. So I don't think it's up to any one group. I think equality and self-government are the key challenges for us, and they're related to each other. Without a sense of being equal citizens with rights and opportunities and status that are common to us all, we don't feel any sense of shared citizenship, and we can't govern ourselves. We've lost what Tocqueville called the art of self-government, which is something you have to learn. It's difficult. It doesn't come naturally. Debate, argument, disagreement, compromise, working together, solving big problems together. Pandemic was such a great opportunity for that, and we failed it. So if equality of life and if the art of self-government together can somehow be strengthened, and I think there's signs that they are being strengthened very slowly and fitfully, then I think there's a chance that we'll get out of the hole we're in and start to become one country again instead of these warring tribes that we've fallen into.
How do you start that process when you've got millions of Americans who, it's not that they don't trust each other in coming up with the right solution. And you write very personally about moving outside of a city into the country and having neighbors on the other side of the political divide and not having the conversation. Because when we don't agree on the facts, when we don't agree that Donald Trump lost in the most secure election in American history, so says the lifelong Republican in charge of our election security, when we don't agree on the facts, you can't have a constructive conversation about why the Republicans lost and what the mandate is for the current president. How do you get out of the gate and do what you're talking about when we live in a post-fact country?
Yeah, that's a crucial question, because there are some basic norms that are essential, without which we can't get anywhere. I mean, agreeing on facts, agreeing on rules, accepting rules, playing by rules instead of trying to break them in order to steal elections or to overthrow elected leaders. I would say accepting each other across lines of race and calling out and absolutely making racial hatred beyond the pale is essential. And that's something we lost a lot of ground on during the presidency of Trump. Without those things, those are basic groundwork for any self-government to be possible. I mean, I think Joe Biden's domestic policy agenda is a good start, because it seems to be focused less on stirring up our animosities, the culture wars. He doesn't play that game. He is trying to improve life, material life, for as many Americans as possible by using government in a positive way. I think that's the start for how to gain some kind of sense of equality, given how utterly unequal we've become in the last couple of generations. On the side of self-government, these are not original ideas. I think national service would force Americans, young Americans, to deal with each other across lines, which we don't have to do now. Now we're all siloed in our social media bubbles. We hate each other, or we play to each other. We try to get cheered by our side at the expense of the other. It's so toxic. It achieves nothing. It's just destruction. Why not actually have physical encounters, the way international agencies get Bosnian Muslims and Serbs or Northern Irish Protestants and Catholics to build school together or to put on a play together. We're at that point where we need deliberate efforts so that Americans from these different narratives, from different backgrounds, have to work together, and probably locally at first, because local problems are easier to solve without getting into the viciousness of national politics, which immediately drives people into their separate corners. I know these are small ideas, they're familiar ideas, but we have to start somewhere, because we're not going to persuade each other. It's not going to be done by berating or telling each other we're wrong or we're stupid. It has to be done by seeing actual change and lowering the temperature when we can see that government can actually make some positive difference.
Congratulations on having the most productive pandemic out of anyone that I have spoken to on this show. The book is really, I should just say, if I read The Unwinding, it was perfect. And this to me feels like the next installation. You certainly see around corners. George Packer, thank you for spending some time with us. The book Last Best Hope is available now. We will be right back. We're monitoring Capitol Hill right now as we are moments away from an historic vote, one that's been a long time coming. Lawmakers in the House expected to pass a bill making June 19th, Juneteenth, a federal holiday. It commemorates the true end of slavery in this country when the last enslaved people in Texas learned about their freedom a whole 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. The Senate passed the bill by unanimous consent yesterday. So as soon as the House passes it, it will go straight to President Biden's desk. Of course, we have to mention the sad irony here. Just as Congress elevates the Juneteenth holiday, there are voter suppression bills in state houses across the country that, of course, disproportionately impact Black Americans. And so the work continues. We will be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.